fusion energy is clearly no longer science fiction and is turning out to offer real potential for our clean energy future. As countries launch dedicated fusion strategies and companies around the world achieve project milestones, it seems to be a question of when, not if, fusion will be achieved. To learn more about the countries and technologies leading the fusion race, as well as what is needed to get fusion over the line, I speak with Andrew Holland, CEO of the Fusion Industry Association. Andrew unpacks the necessary elements for a robust supply chain and supportive regulatory framework, and emphasizes fusion's role in promoting a separation between geopolitics and energy. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Andrew, thank you for joining me today to talk about something that was perhaps considered science fiction, but it's definitely now science fact, and that is, of course, fusion energy. So, first question, is there a race to fusion energy? And if so, which countries are in pole position?
Well, first of all, Pamela, thank you for having me. Thanks for your interest here. It is a very exciting time in fusion energy. And the reason is because there is a race going on. I do think, though, that we make a mistake sometimes in our framing about who the race is between. We think about the space race, like the Soviet Union versus the United States, who would get to the moon first. But that's not actually how this is playing out. The race right now is between the companies, the developers, the programs that are building their fusion machines. Who's going to get to fusion first? Who's going to commercialize it? And then who's going to scale it? So while it's tempting to say it's the US racing with China, you know, with Germany, the UK, Japan, all along the side, what's really the way it plays out is that there's kind of a global fusion energy program. It's been, you know, scientists have worked together and shared information for decades together. And then now there are private companies, and in some places of the world, China especially, public companies as well, that are now working to take all of that scientific knowledge and put it into a commercial machine. And so they're all racing against each other. So it's companies in the United States that I'd say are probably in the lead right now, but they're being chased very closely by companies in China and companies in Germany with perhaps opportunities for programs in the United Kingdom and programs in Japan to jump on that as well. And then, you know, the other thing to kind of mix this up a little bit as well is that it's like a technology race as well. So you have the traditional magnetically confined fusion, with fusion in a magnetic bottle versus ICF, inertially confined fusion, using lasers to hit a fuel target. You know, the race is on and it's happening in multiple different places. And it's tricky because it's on multiple different tracks. You know, it's not all everybody racing on the same track against each other and getting to the same finish line. So I'm sorry to make it a little more complicated, but I guess that's just the way it kind of is.
Let's be honest, fusion is complicated. And as you were describing some of the technologies there, I want to encourage you to get as technical as possible, because really the technology is fascinating. And I think that that brings me to my next question, because there seems to have been such advancements in the technology, in the kit, in the last decade. And with that has come almost a renewed interest in fusion. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with that. And, you know, I think it's only natural that it's coming at this time. Because if think about all of the other technology advances, things in your phone, AI, compute, material science, all of these other things are happening at the same time as plasma physics, the real understanding of how fusion works, has been advancing for decades. Look, we've been doing fusion in labs since the 1950s. And so there's been this sort of buildup of knowledge and understanding over many, many years. And it was done really in national labs, university science programs, and it was done starting actually in 1958. It was done internationally. Even at the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union, the United States, the UK agreed to open their books to each other to show what they're doing on fusion. Basically, what happened was that it turned out to be a lot harder than they expected it to be. And so we should all kind of work together and share knowledge across borders. And so the scientists were working on that. And then throughout, you know, say the last 20 years, we've gotten to the point where the scientists are confident that the next machine they build will work. And by say work, I mean it will be a break-even fusion machine. More energy out than in. I'm not saying it will be a pilot plant. I'm not saying it will generate electricity. But the scientists are confident that the next machine would work. But the problem is, in fusion, is that these next machines had always gotten to be more and more expensive and more difficult to build, take longer. And so the result of that process was actually ITER, which is the big fusion experiment in the south of France. Fusion scientists around the world put together to say, what is the way we can build this with the most confidence that it will work? And so they built this really big machine, or agreed to build this really big machine. It's still in process. It's now many, many years behind schedule, billions and billions of dollars over budget. It doesn't mean it's waste. It just means that fusion is hard. And so what happened in the span between when they started to contemplate this machine and now, you know, when they started to actually get it all put together and done, is that all of these other scientific advances happened. So in the case of magnetically confined fusion, which is what ITER is, the big innovation is high temperature superconductors. So HTS wire allows you to, by wrapping them together, it allows you to make the most powerful magnets in the world. And because now private company, Commonwealth Fusion Systems, has demonstrated that they can make this 20 Tesla magnet, the most powerful magnet ever made, that means that you can add a lot more power into the fusion system. So you can scale down the size of the fusion machine while still having more power go through it. So that means that you can build a lot faster. Just by the nature of it being smaller, it means you've got a lot less concrete, a lot less steel, a lot less of all of this stuff. And you can just build it faster by the physical need for it and build it cheaper. So that's kind of the commercial viability there. So we've got ITER being built in the south of France. And, you know, in 2021, Commonwealth Fusion started to build what they called Spark. That's their demonstration machine in Devens, Massachusetts. And, you know, here we are now 5 years later, and it is nearly complete. And so Spark will be completed this year, go into testing and turn it on next year. And we hope pretty soon after that to see that it becomes the break-even fusion machine that will demonstrate that fusion can be done in a commercially viable way, in a machine that will inform the next machine, which is a pilot plant. And so, you know, in these other technology sectors, we see similar sort of timelines and movement and, you know, ways forward. And it's different technology that is the thing that's moved forward. In laser inertial fusion, the new technology is diodes. Diodes allow you to build lasers much more resilient, much cheaper, much smaller, and so to have more. So it's everybody's got their own sort of, you know, what's the magic that allows you to commercialize this? But it's basically the common thing is taking this technology advances from all of these other places and applying it to plasma physics that has grown more and more science over time and really gotten us there. That's why it's so exciting. That's why you see all of these different companies, all of these different ways forward, and, you know, billions and billions of dollars in investment going into this.
I think it's fascinating, as you say, you know, you've got Etter, which is this monster, and it's chunky and it's a little bit slow, but it seems like as you've kind of shrunk the size of these things and, you know, it's showing commercial viability, which is very exciting. Are there any particular technologies that you think we need to keep an eye on?
This is a challenge here. So we have 45 member companies in the FIA, and virtually all of them are different some way.
So you can't actually pick a favorite child. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, I can't pick a favorite child. And it's not that each of them has an equal pathway or equal likelihood of getting there, but they all have an opportunity to get there. They wouldn't be a member of the FIA if there wasn't some sort of pathway towards getting there. What I'd just say is that, you know, there's going to be some consolidation in this industry as companies move forward and different technologies prove their value in different places. You know, some of these are really good for steady state operations. Accelerator, which is a magnetically confined fusion machine that's kind of twisted. Tokamak's a donut. Accelerator's a crawler. Accelerator is really good for steady state operations. A tokamak is the one that we know the most about. So it's there's been over 100 tokamaks built around the world. So it's kind of in the pole position right now. But you know, laser inertial fusion, there's multiple different iterations and versions even within that. I think we have 11 laser fusion companies within the FIA, and they're all a little bit different. Different designs of the laser or different target designs or different ways of turning it into electricity. So it's hard for me to say which to keep an eye on. Keep an eye on all of them. Make your own choices. But the things that I think you should, industry or investors should maybe keep an eye on are the things that are behind the fusion plasma physics itself, and actually think about kind of what's the supply chain, what's the enabling technology. And in a lot of these, it's power supplies, pulse power, capacitors, that sort of stuff. In the magnets, it's that high temperature superconducting wire I mentioned. In in lasers, it's advancements in laser technology, in optics technology. So it's starting to think through what is the thing that's developed in the last decade or two that enables all of this other plasma physics. So that's where I'd say, what should we look at? Well, you know, kind of look at what's advancing most rapidly because of innovations in other places, innovations in semiconductors, innovations in clean technology, power management, that sort of stuff.
Mentioning the supply chain is actually a good segue into my next question to you, Andrew. And that is, if I think about fusion, it's such a nascent technology, or the sector is really, there's a way to go. Let's just say that. So help me understand, how do we ensure that the supply chain is developed alongside the technology? And perhaps we can also touch on things like the regulatory framework as well, because, I mean, surely there's a lot of work that needs to be done here.
Yeah, well, so that's my job, right? That's the FIA's, the Fusion Industry Association's job, is to make sure that all of these other speed bumps or hurdles are out of the pathway before the companies, the technologists, get this to something that is ready to commercialize. So we talk about supply chain. There is a potential case here where a company commercializes, builds the first fusion pilot plant, commercializes fusion, but then if it's not ready to scale up, if you build one, and then you build another one 2 years later, and then another one 2 years after that. Is that success? I think what we need to think about is real scale. Look at our energy challenges, our climate and energy problems, and they are massive. And so they require scale. The energy system is massive. So that requires scale. And so if a Western company in the United States, UK, Germany, Japan gets this, but then the Chinese are the ones that are actually able to scale soon after. We've seen this story before. We've seen this in solar. We've seen it in batteries, electric vehicles. We're seeing it in real time right now. And so if we don't learn the lesson from that, then I think we're just going to doomed to repeat the same mistakes. So we do need to scale up the supply chain alongside this. Here in the United States, the FIA is working in Congress on a tax credit bill that would enable fusion supply chain, fusion manufacturing for domestic production with a 30% tax credit. This allows more investment, allows more scale by supply chain companies. Part of the supply chain thing is an education issue, right? Because a lot of these supply chain companies are not your giant multinational companies. They are family-owned businesses that bid on one-off projects here or there. But if they can get into this and then they can scale, they have to make their own investment to then sell into it, then, you know, the sky's the limit, but they have to start to do that soon so that they're ready to scale when industry is ready to scale. You know, I think sometimes about, think of another technology, you know, the iPhone, right? It was one of the biggest business winners from that was actually Corning. You know, old school glass maker, but it made the glass for the iPhone. And they had all sorts of manufacturing difficulties, being able to scale it up and get it done. And there's all these stories about Steve Jobs flying to upstate New York and trying to get it all done and ready. And it's all of this. The lesson is that this is all challenging, but worthwhile, because suddenly Corning, you know, this century old company, becomes a darling of the stock market, sees its valuation go up. I think there's many stories like that to come in the fusion supply chain, but we got to get it done. And, you know, I do think sometimes that those places in the world that have invested in their domestic manufacturing better than, you know, than honestly the United States has done. As you can hear from my accent, I'm American, based here in Washington, D.C. But, you know, actually, Germany, Italy, Japan, they've made more investments into keeping a domestic high-tech manufacturing supply chain available. Never mind China. And so, you know, there's a way here that I think we can't just put up walls and we can't just think about it has to be a supply chain built where the developer is. This is a global system. This is a global supply chain. And we have to be really strategic about the things that need to be onshored versus the things that need to be friendshored, and strategic about thinking about, well, where is the actual benefits going through here? So, you know, I tend to think that fusion is a sort of G7 technology. So the G7 developed countries, these are the ones that can all work together, and we can find, you know, ways to work things through, you know, add a couple of countries here, Korea, Singapore, maybe such like that. I think that's kind of the supply chain base that enables the real growth here. We don't want an autarkic, you know, no trade sort of approach. And then finally, your question on regulation. That is critical, because fusion cannot be treated in the same regime as nuclear fission. Nuclear fission is regulated very heavily around the world. And it's right to be regulated very heavily, because if things go wrong, it can get unsafe really quickly, right? So you have a lot of condensed fuel, you have spent nuclear waste, you have all of these, you know, molecules that can really get dangerous really quickly. A lot of fuel inside the reactor at one time. Fusion's the exact opposite. Fusion is very hard to start and easy to stop. Fission is easy to start, hard to stop. And so just based on its safety profile, fusion needs to be regulated in a very different way. And so here in the United States and in the UK, we have confirmed that fusion will be regulated completely separately from nuclear fission. It'll be regulated like a particle accelerator, a medical isotope facility. So that's appropriate. That's the way to do it. It doesn't mean there's no risk. It doesn't mean there's no regulation. It just means that it's the appropriate level of regulation, and it should really allow us to scale and build and move quickly here. And so we're really excited about progress on regulation. It's going to constantly have to be making sure that regulators are comfortable with this, that the general public is comfortable with this. But you know, we're confident that this pathway is on the right track. We're going to get this done before we have fusion power plants and not have to wait, you know, a year or two for regulatory approval when the science is ready.
You mentioned, you know, public perception and also education, just that whole idea of whether or not, you know, if you do have a fusion power plant, if it would be accepted by communities. Do you think that that might be an issue? I mean, nuclear can be quite challenging, I think, in that sense, because people are a little bit afraid, you know, it doesn't have perhaps a great safety record in their minds. Is fusion facing the same?
So far, no. All evidence so far is that fusion is going to be accepted. Where we've seen fusion companies site and build experimental machines, they have done work in their local community to make sure the community is aware of what's going on. We can't hide the ball here. There's stuff happening here. There's tritium, which is a radioactive gas involved. There is neutrons and radiation being put out when the fusion machine is on. So we've got to be very clear about this. But in general, when we've gone through the process and talked about how exciting it is that there is a new clean technology coming on, then folks really should want it. So I think that's a really exciting moment. And so far we've seen that it should be in the right place. It's hard to tell, you know, we see Germany, which is notably anti-nuclear in its public, making a big push for nuclear fusion, not nuclear fission. They said, fission doesn't work. We don't want that. But they said, fusion, yes, let's double down. Let's go. Let's move fast on that.
Yeah, potentially viewing fusion as a way towards, I think, Europe's key goals at the moment, which is energy sovereignty and independence. And I think, you know, just also working towards those decarbonization goals. And I'd like to get your opinion on this, Andrew. You know, currently we are experiencing some geopolitical tensions, to put it mildly, and obviously we have a situation impacting our energy situation and the supply thereof. Do you think that these kinds of energy crises could push us more quickly towards achieving fusion?
Yeah, look, we're in the largest energy crisis since the 1970s right now. I think actually markets haven't priced in as much of the crisis that we're going to be seeing. We, the broader general we here in the United States and Europe, you know, from what I understand, areas in Asia are already feeling it even worse. So yes, I think there is a real understanding that there needs to be a separation, a geopolitical separation on energy. The great thing about fusion is that geopolitical separation, right? If you think about all other sources of energy, they are geographically dependent in one way or another, whether it is oil and gas, which is underground somewhere in the world and has to be pulled up and taken out. And that's a windfall for wherever that is. So whether it's the Middle East or whether it's Texas, whether it's the North Sea, that is a windfall, both geopolitically and economically for that region. But it creates dependencies. And we see how those dependencies can then be weaponized. We saw it in 2022 with Russia invading Ukraine and the turnoff of natural gas. I mean, Russia had been using its dependencies in Eastern Europe on natural gas for a decade before that, trying to kind of pull these threads and use that geopolitical leverage there. And the way to blunt that weapon is to build something that is geographically independent. And that's what fusion will do. It will be something that turns energy from something you pull out of the ground or you get from the sun or the wind, the weather, into something that is manufactured, something you do in a factory. And the only limit to it, really fundamentally, the only limit to it is how fast you can manufacture that. And evidence from the last century is that once you put something on a manufacturing line, then you can scale it, you can drive costs down, and you can just build more and more of it. And so that's why I'm really excited about this. You know, my last job before starting the FIA was in a national security think tank. And I left there because I wanted to actually build security instead of just talking about it. So I think fusion is the key thing that will enable this.
That actually is fascinating, because I wanted to ask you if maybe when, as a youth, if you thought, one day I'd like to work in fusion energy, or how did you come to work in this? But as you say, I mean, it's about security and defense. This is key.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to say that I had this vision to start a fusion association when I was 10 years old or something like that. I can say I grew up in New Jersey, and actually I do remember in middle school, we took a field trip to Princeton Plasma Physics Lab and went to the TFTR, the tokamak test reactor there. And so I do remember taking that through, but I can't claim that that was the thing that got me on board and pushed me into this. Actually, the reason I'm involved in fusion is because fusion solves problems. There's real problems we have in our global energy system, national energy systems, and fusion is the thing that solves those problems. So that's why I want to get this on board. There's scientists who lead some of our companies who are and scientists in national labs who are really into it because it's a really exquisite scientific problem. And, you know, solving that exquisite scientific problem is the challenge of a lifetime. I'm not there. I'd love to more power to them, get it done. But I'm here for fusion because of the impact it will have, because of how it will solve these problems that we, the collective we of the world, face. I think a fusion world is a world that's safer. You know, you started it by saying, well, fusion sounds like science fiction, but a lot of things sound like science fiction. You know, if you asked 100 years ago, if you could talk to somebody across the oceans on a video screen, that sounds like science fiction. They'd say, well, what's a video screen, right? And so, you know, the march of progress means that, you know, we continue to move forward, we continue to find things, and actually science fiction holds a lot of clues about the way we're going. So I'm doing this because it's going to solve a problem, solve multiple problems at the same time, and we've got to move as fast as we can to do that.
Well, Andrew, I am no scientist, but I can tell you your enthusiasm is contagious, and it is certainly an exciting space to watch. So thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your insights with our listeners.
Thanks, Pamela.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Logg, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.